Thank you. Also for reminding me, Jim, about the benefits of terminated gene technology. The outline that Jim has presented, in fact, is an enticing outline. It really does point to what the theoretical possibility of some of the Generation 2 biofuels are able to do. And when people suggest to me that there is, in fact, a major crisis facing the world, and there is in terms of our appointment with peak oil, and they say to me, "Well, is there a solution?" Of course, there is a solution. I mean, humankind has always been able to meet challenges and overcome them. And those of you who ever studied some of the early forms of economic theory would be familiar with the economics, the theory of a gentleman called Malthus. And Malthus predicted that there was a linear comparability between the capacity of the food-growing ability of the globe and the rate at which the population of the Earth was growing, and that those two lines would actually cross, and that they would cross at about 1840, about the year 1840, and beyond that, the world would die of starvation. And of course, we all know since then that the population of the world has just continued to grow. Malthusian economics failed, as will, I believe, the predictions of the end of the world. In point of fact, from the point of view of a farmer within living memory, we had a situation where our wheat belt farms in places like Meriden and Muckumburden, that area that I originally come from, actually didn't import any oil at all. They grew all of their own fuel, and they managed to be significant exporters because those farms ran on horses, and horses ate grass. And the horses of the future may well eat grass, or microalgae, as Jim would like to call it. It's a form of marine grass. The capacity, for example, to, and Jim didn't go into this because he was talking about direct sunlight capture microalgae, but the capacity of connecting microalgae plants into the carbon capture mechanisms of gas-fired and even coal-fired power plants is actually there within reach. Scientifically, you can do it now, which will take out all of the CO2 from that coal-fired power plant, all of the NOx from that coal-fired power plant, and actually consume it as feed for that algae. It's part of the feed. So these things are there. They're within scientific reach. And I believe that we will get there. These are all Generation 2. To get to Generation 2, it has always been my view that we need to pass through the process of Generation 1, and indeed Generation 1.5, which people aren't even talking about yet, but which is arriving now. And we have trials out there at this very moment around Generation 1.5, and that is the growing of tree-based biofuel crops, which are capable of growing on land not currently used for agriculture. Plants like Moringa oleifera and Pongamia pinnata, for example, are two plants where Moringa, as an instance, yields something like 5 times the oil yield of canola, 5 times the oil yield. It has a capacity to produce at year 5 something between 2,000 and 2,500 litres per hectare of prime biodiesel. And they're out there now. We're actually growing those plants now. We have trials at Kununurra, in the Gascoyne, even at Katanning. And in fact, Dr. Henry Brockman is here now. He's just returned from Tamil Nadu University, where he assures me he's brought back a cast iron deal. Is it, Henry, with Tamil Nadu? Thank you, Henry. So it's all out there to do, and I think what we are looking at here is an enormously exciting opportunity. Can I acknowledge Tom Baddeley, the Executive Director of the Committee for Economic Development of Australia, Professor Jim Reynoldson, the Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research, Murdoch University, and thank you very much, Jim, for the advertisement. I think that was really great. Brian Harrison, the Chief Executive Officer of Biofuels Association of Australia, and all of you here who've come, many of you from a very, very long distance, to be with us today. Thank you also for your invitation to attend this luncheon forum. But peak oil I referred to earlier. In 2003, for Australia's liquid oil production was basically line ball, self-sufficient. 78% of production came from our local sources. By 2030, it's envisaged that this will fall to 50% self-sufficiency. The same scenario exists globally. There are increasing indications that peak oil production either has been reached or will be reached in the very near future. It doesn't matter much which side of the argument you fall on. The fact is, it's pretty bad news in terms of peak oil. Biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel, will not be the sole solution to reducing our state's solution on fossil fuels. But they are likely to be cost competitive with oil. They have the advantage of being compatible with current engine technology and the infrastructure which is used in transport. It's not, for example, that huge step you've got to make to go to a hydrogen technology, for example. It's not that huge infrastructure step. Biofuels, relatively adaptable to our system. A little over a year ago, the West Australian Biofuels Task Force, which was established as a result of a motion in the Legislative Assembly in Western Australia, gave us some 24 recommendations to consider. Since then, a range of issues have arisen which require more investigation before I think I'm able to take a sensible strategy to Cabinet for consideration. We've seen enormous changes in those 12 months, and to ask government to comment on those recommendations is a reasonable question, but government will also have to consider the changes which have occurred in the meantime. One of the biggest issues which has occurred in those 12 months, of course, has been the sometimes absurd food versus fuels debate. Biofuels are being blamed for a shortage of food and the rise in global food prices, particularly in corn, yellow corn, to ethanol in the USA, even though yellow corn is not a human consumption food. If these arguments were in context even remotely true, given that sugar to ethanol began as an industrial process in Brazil way back in about 1985, give or take a year, if those arguments were remotely true, sugar producers now would be enjoying the highest ever sugar prices that the world has known. Last year, or the year before last, I had the really difficult and painful task of shutting down our sugar industry in Western Australia because the price of sugar had never been lower in real terms. The increase in the use of sugar did not result in an increase in price of sugar. We are still stuck around the 8 cents per US pound, 8 cents US per pound, in terms of sugar prices. It didn't have the effect that is being imputed in relation to the corn to ethanol deal. Ethanol in the US, as I said, is produced from yellow corn. It's a feedstock which is not considered suitable for direct human consumption, and current production of ethanol from yellow corn is estimated to cover 200 million barrels of oil. Rice, which is not used for biofuel production anywhere, and nor is it in any case substitutable by yellow corn, has had the greatest price escalation amongst all of the three main traded grains. That is, yellow corn, wheat, and rice. Of those three, rice is the big hitter in the market, and yet rice is not used for biofuel production anywhere. The fact is that a number of studies have concluded, and I'm happy to say, and Tom referred to it briefly earlier today, this was confirmed by the OECD's report, which came out today, have concluded that the combination of the world's shortages of grain due to adverse conditions, Australia, Argentina, Ukraine, and the ever-increasing affluence in China and India are actually the major reasons for the demand-side issues and the supply-side issues of food price rises. Just to give you one little look into that window, China's meat consumption has increased by 112% since 1995. Almost all of China's meat consumption is pork. All pork in China is grain-fed. So when you increase meat consumption in a country of, what, 1.2 billion people? 1.2 billion, roundly? The biggest pork producer in the world, and it's all grain-fed, the odds are you're going to have a fair amount of grain going down the throats of pigs. And indeed, if you look at that single factor, just the increasing amount of grain which has gone down the throat of pigs to feed that increase of 112% in meat production since 1995, that amount of grain massively passes the little bit of grain, the 1% of world production that's currently going into biofuel. So let's get over this issue of economic nonsense around biofuel's role in world food prices, even assuming that you think world food prices are a bad thing. I mean, as a former wheat grower, I've got to suggest to you that, in fact, what we are seeing now is a market correction. Over the last decade or two, what we have seen is artificially low grain prices as a result of the corrupted markets coming out of the EU and US grain subsidies, which have corrupted markets to the extent that the Europeans and the United States are still paying farmers not to grow wheat. So at one stage we have allegations that the demand side has been increased as a result of biofuel demand, but on the other side, on the supply side, we are still paying farmers not to grow wheat. It's called the set-aside. You set aside 1,000 acres of wheat-growing land in Nebraska and we will pay you X dollars. It's still going on. Still. And it will go on in the next production year as well, because the USDA can't work out a way to wind back that operation. Still going on in the European Union. We are still paying farmers to be in the not-growing grain business at the same time as we're saying we are artificially inflating the price of grain. So let's get over that and try to look at this issue of food versus fuel in its proper context. There are several other issues arising from the Biofuels Task Force report, which include the cost of feedstock for biofuel production and the energy balance of biofuels. For example, canola production in Western Australia is for human consumption, either for domestic crushing or for export. The current price of canola oil out of Western Australia is about $1,300 a tonne, and that makes the processing of canola oil to biodiesel in large plants a non-economic proposition. The same was true of tallow, which was the basis of production for Australian renewables fuels plant in Picton, which closed down because human consumption demand out of China was prepared to pay more than biofuel production in Picton could pay. And this again is something that we've got to consider. Generally speaking, human food markets can pay more than the biofuel market can. Once that occurs, you've reached a threshold. Biofuels play no role at all in the price structure of that commodity. Nevertheless, I think a self-sustaining strategy for some farmers in Western Australia could be to produce their own biodiesel on farm for their annual production cycle and so reduce their dependence on imported diesel. Current work, which is being done by the Department of Agriculture and Food on mustard varieties in particular, indicates that this might be a much more suitable crop than canola in our cool temperate agricultural area. That's due in part to a lower production cost for mustard vis-a-vis canola, and also the greater adaptability of that crop than canola to Western Australian agricultural conditions. But so far, the preferred crop for Western Australia, which has been identified for ethanol production, is feed-grade wheat. This is wheat which is not entirely suitable for human consumption, generally because it has a very low falling number test and usually low protein as well. It's already produced as a part of our existing crop production system. It's a commodity that's there in volumes around 400,000 tonnes a year. In those volumes, there is enough feed grade and GP, general purpose wheat, available to ensure that we can produce enough ethanol to fully support an E10 blend throughout Western Australia. That's around 430 million litres of ethanol. Over and above that, you have a stock feed stream, the wet or the dry distiller's grain, which comes out of the industrial process. We have seen the recent withdrawal by BP from a joint venture to commission a 160 million litre per year ethanol plant at Kwinana, and that is discouraging for those of us who support the industry. But I think that is a temporary setback. I think we are going to see a large-scale wheat-to-ethanol production plant in Western Australia sometime in the future. And I think the economic factors which exist around those numbers mean that that is inevitable. I want to briefly discuss some urgent research and development needs and opportunities, though, at this stage. And although there is huge international literature available on the life cycle analysis of biofuels, and indeed these were referred to also in that OECD report today, also in the area of production practices and yields worldwide, I have to say that there are significant differences between those international benchmarks and what happens here in Western Australia. The energy balance and the environmental impact of biofuels, particularly in that specific area of wheat to ethanol, is currently being investigated by the Department of Agriculture and Food and the CSIRO via a life cycle analysis based for the first time on local data. And I believe that we're not far off having that that data available. That data will form a valuable input into the decision-making process that government will make in terms of the issues around targets and mandates in relation to the biofuel cycle. Research into production of biodiesel from perennials, which I referred to as Generation 1.5, such as the oilseed-bearing tree species, is being conducted by the Department of Agriculture and Food. We have trials throughout the state, but ranging from Kununurra to Katanning. Two tree species, Moringa oleifera and Pongamia pinnata, are being trialled at different locations throughout Western Australia. Seeds are harvested, leaving the trees to grow, and the tree goes on sequestering carbon. The trees can grow on marginal land. Indeed, some of the best performance that we've had has been in the Gascoyne region. They also have some tolerance to salinity. Investigations are currently underway with two mining companies who are interested in utilising those species for the production of biofuel at the mine site, using mine dewatering flows as their irrigation source. There are global initiatives in capturing carbon dioxide from power plants, I referred to that earlier, and using algae-based bioreactors to convert the carbon dioxide to biodiesel. And they are so worthy of investigation, I think it's something that we need to be very, very excited about them, particularly if that CO2 is generated from renewable sources or unavoidable sources such as coal-fired power generation. And I really hope that Western Australia can be at the forefront of the development of that technology. This includes watching the development of ethanol from cellulose, that is generation two. There are millions of dollars at the moment being invested in research and development globally on that issue. Commercial viable production seems to be some years away yet, but the technology for this process is well understood. I think it was discovered by the United States Army in 1945. The problem is nobody's been able to overcome the cost issues. But I think the exciting prospect for us is that biofuel production can offer whole new opportunities to diversify income and employment in rural areas. At one level, we tend to think about this in its macroeconomics, but if you bring it down to a geopolitical level, the contribution that biofuels can make not only to established rural communities, as we know from the Wheat Belt or even from the pastoral zone, but when I go to speak to people representing Indigenous communities who are now paying $2.40, $2.50 a litre for diesel, not only for their transport but to also generate their power, the prospects of having a fuel manufacturing system that they can actually control within their own production capacity, on their own land, with their own water, is just such an exciting thing. This can be a revolution on geopolitical levels for those little communities out there and for those people in regional communities who so need an even break. Consideration to get there, we need to give consideration to updating the current pastoral tenure system and the diversification permit arrangements that we have to enable the flexibility and the timely diversification opportunities for biofuel production in those remote areas. But to do that, and that's a small administrative thing, to do that can enable an unlocking of such enormous potential for people's lives that it doesn't matter much what happens globally, it could make so much difference to them that it would be justified in its own right. When I do receive the life cycle analysis that I referred to earlier, I'll consider the recommendations of the Biofuels Task Force report and I'll present my recommendations to Cabinet. I feel confident, though, that my colleagues in Cabinet will support biofuel development with the object of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, of boosting the decarbonisation of transport fuels, of diversifying our fuel supply sources, developing long-term replacements for fossil fuel, but importantly providing economic opportunities for some of our most disadvantaged people, and reducing the pollution levels in our cities and towns. So one of the most striking things to me in this issue was when I first went to Brazil, to the city of São Paulo, and we flew into São Paulo, which is a huge city, 15 million people, flew into São Paulo in the early morning, but it was daylight. Big city, you could see from one end of it to the other. When you fly into Sydney or Melbourne, you can't do that because it disappears out into a sort of a grey fog at one end or the other, and you can't see in Sydney much past Hornby on a clear day. São Paulo, you can see from one end of the city, three times the size of Sydney, to the other end. And you go into the main street of São Paulo, and this is a boom town, a third world boom town. Six lanes of traffic going one way, six lanes of traffic going the other, and the air smells like a forest. This is the exact opposite of what you're used to in Bangkok, for example. Who had to mention Bangkok? No, the tuk-tuks are all gone. But the air smells clean. The really remarkable thing is when you speak to the proponents of the ethanol industry in Brazil, that's the one thing they never bother mentioning. They just take it for granted that they've got clean air. It's a significant issue. I feel confident that biofuels are going to make a major contribution in one way or another to our economic growth. My confidence grows with every increase in oil prices. And I've got to the stage now that when I hear that oil today reached a record price of $148.5 per barrel of West Texas crude, I actually celebrate now. I actually celebrate. Because I can see the confidence that this is bringing into the biofuel sector. These prices are in real terms where they should have been anyway. This is where the prices should have been. I went out in 1973, believe it or not, and I'm actually on record as saying this, saying that Australia should get in behind OPEC in 1973 because OPEC were doing the right thing and all suppliers of primary commodities should be following OPEC's lead. I only wish we all had, and I only wish we'd given OPEC the kind of support that we should have then. Finally, let me just say, in terms of where the role of government is in this issue and the way in which the issue has changed over the last 12 months and specifically because of the increase in oil prices, it's no longer fanciful to argue that the change to biofuels in Australia is inevitable. I've used that word once before, but it's not fanciful now to say it's going to happen anyway. It's inevitable for purely commercial reasons. The question of government policy, which as recently as 12 months ago was thought to be crucial, is probably now irrelevant. Thank you very much.